This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashrin Johan. On today's show, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of different issues centered around Malaysian Indians. Now, on the first half of the show, we will be talking about the K word yet again. Recently, women's single shuttler S. Kisona, she represented Malaysia in the Sudirman Cup. During a match against the Japanese Akane Yamaguchi, a Malaysian politician from Bersatu took to Facebook to make an absolutely disgusting statement. He said, and I quote, "From which estate did the Badminton Association of Malaysia pick this K word from to represent Malaysia?" Obviously, he actually mentioned in full what the K word actually is. On the second half of the show, we will be discussing the recent Foodpanda advertisement. If you are unaware, Foodpanda recently released an Indian cinema musical themed kind of advertisement ahead of Deepavali celebrations. Now, the problem is there isn't a single Indian talent in the advertisement. Yes, it's an Indian musical style advertisement ahead of Deepavali with no Indians. So joining me on the show today to hopefully help me make sense of this, to discuss both these issues, first up is Vanisha Krishnasamy. She's the founder of Unmuted, which is a Malaysian collective to empower and center brown marginalized voices. She's also an advocacy journalist. She's a content creator, producer. She makes great content on Instagram about these issues as well. Welcome to the show, Nisha. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm good.
Also joining me on the show today is Deepan Kumar. They are also one of the co-founders of Unmuted, and they're an inter-varsity debater that has represented Malaysia at multiple international debating championships. Welcome, Deepan. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm doing good. I'm a big fan of the show, big fan of the segment. So yeah, super excited.
Thank you. Let's start with you, Nisha. How did it make you feel when you caught wind of the Facebook post by the politician?
It was really upsetting, but at the same time, it was also not surprising, which is really sad to say. Unfortunately, we've gotten quite used to being on the receiving end of racial slurs like this. But that being said, it shouldn't be normalized, and it still hurts every time we receive it. So I guess in essence, in short, it would be upset, but not surprised, unfortunately.
What about you, Deepan? How did that Facebook post make you feel?
I think it was a very violent reminder of what kind of society we're in, because, you know, that word, I feel like it's been some time since I've had it used against me, because I think the last I can remember is maybe in like high school with like my bullies, right? And it did bring back a lot of baggage and trauma. So that was very painful to witness and to see, you know, it being done out in the open unapologetically initially and then eventually apologetically. But yeah, that was, I think, a very sad reminder of the kind of society that we're in.
Now, Deepan, what would you say to people who argue, you know, you've probably heard it before. I've heard it before. We've seen it on social media. You know, whenever this topic comes up, there will be people who say, no lah, you know, the K word isn't racist at all. It's not a racial slur. It's just how I refer to Indians, you know, how my grandfather refers to Indians. And we do it, you know, in a neutral manner. But clearly it's made both of y'all upset. A lot of Indian people, whether you go on social media and all, have been speaking out about this. A lot of people are upset. So how would you respond to people who say, no, this is not a racist word, you all just, you know, you all need to calm down and things like that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a sentiment that I've seen very often as well. And I think there's two parts to this. I think first, there's sort of the historical origin of the word, and then there's the sort of contemporary use of it, right, in today's society or in the recent Malaysian society. And historically, when you look at it, it doesn't sound very harmful. Like, it's, you know, we've had many, many different origins to it, like whether it's referring to, you know, Kalinga, the kingdom where we said we were from, or, you know, the sounds of, you know, the falangu that you wear when you play, when you dance Bharatanatyam, right? So these all don't sound very harmful. But when you look at the contemporary use of it, when you talk to any Malaysian Indian and you ask them, how has this word been used against you? I think in like 9 out of 10 of those times, if not 10 out of 10 of those times, you'll find that the answer is always in some derogatory sense, whether it's your bully, whether it's somebody trying to make fun of you, expressing a colorism sentiment, you know, it's always paired with this word. And so while people can say that it's a word that can be descriptive in nature and neutral, you can't, of course, discount the fact that it is very loaded with a lot of baggage that comes from, you know, derogatory use of it. And I don't want to defend against a low-hanging fruit here as well. Like, I think people need to realize that intent behind using this word isn't always the only thing. Like, you can use this word without having bad intent, but it can still bring about that baggage and trauma to the average Malaysian Indian as well, because it has been used for generations as an insult and to debase the Malaysian Indian identity. So, yeah, I think that's what I would say to them, to always look at what the Indians are saying right now and what their experiences are, and to give that legitimacy, to give that validity.
Nisha, it's the thing is, it's not just that the racial slur is being used, because, you know, that, as Deepan mentioned, as we've, you know, established, it's wrong. But what the entire post represents, because even without that K word, the post is still pretty harmful, isn't it? Because it feels to me like when you're from a minority or marginalized, in the case of Malaysia, we're talking about, you know, mostly ethnic Indians and things like that, you're always representing your entire race, especially when things are going bad. It always feels like that. Like, and I think, you know, Sivanandi Tanindran, she's a women's rights activist from Arrow, she put it best on her Facebook when she said, when we fail, our failure, you know, is seen like a symbol of the community, a failed community, a failing community, a community of failures. This is a problem, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think this problem rises from the fact that there aren't many of us represented in spaces like this, that when the few of us do manage to make it, so much pressure is put onto the person who is, who has made it in some ways, whether it's on a national scale or international scale. But the problem with that, of course, is the fact that it's unfair to a marginalized person to be put under so much pressure, because to even make it that far would mean to have to overcome so many different kinds of hurdles and with very limited access, right? So the accesses that marginalized people have are not the same as what anyone else from the majority race would have. And that being said, the ability to succeed should not be measured equally to them. And this is again not me saying that therefore that means that marginalized people cannot succeed. We can, and we have proven to, but it is with great difficulty and by overcoming so much struggle, so much hurdles, and so much of pushback. The amount of effort that needs to be put in by a marginalized person to succeed is different than someone who isn't. So that kind of understanding and therefore empathy must be given to people from marginalized communities when viewing the way that they represent, whether it's an organization, whether it's a country, for any kind of establishment, honestly.
Deepan, I want to get your thoughts on this as well, because this reminds me of some of the conversations we also see in the US when it comes to, let's say, the African American community, the Black community in the US, where, you know, whenever there's a movie starring a Black person or Black directors and all of these things, right, it always feels like it's put under a microscope. This movie has to be the biggest financial success. It has to achieve critical acclaim. It has to do that. And if it doesn't, let's say if it's a bomb, you know, it fails at the box office, everyone will say, you see, that is why we said, right, you shouldn't have a Black-led movie, movies with Black directors, Black stars, Black co-stars, Black ensembles aren't going to do well. You know, we always hear this thing. And something a critique mentioned really struck a chord with me. And what they said was that it's not just about giving minorities the opportunity to be successful. That's important. But it's also giving the opportunity or the space for minorities to fail just like any other groups without facing this extra pressure of you're carrying the whole community with you, right? Because how many movies in this example starring white celebrities, white actors, made by white directors that fail at the box office as well, but nobody points to that and say, oh, it's because you're white, that's why it fails, right? Do you think there's a sort of parallels here? What are your thoughts on this?
I think you put it very spectacularly there. I think it's also important to note that as minorities, we don't get as many opportunities to succeed as well. So people oftentimes, mm-hmm. when they put these minority movie, minority art under the microscope, what they're not realizing is they're being hypercritical of a piece of art or a piece of work that comes from a place that never had the opportunity to have that support, to have that reach, to have that traffic, right? And so it's really unfair, you know, when people place this on such a high pedestal and critique it as though it is a critique of something that has had the ability to have the fanfare of other white counterparts or majority counterparts and other forms of art. So I think that can also be applied to, you know, in the context of athletes as well. You know, even if you look in America, like Simone Biles, for example, look at the kind of pressure that she was under when she had to go to the Olympics, right? To the point where it culminated in, I mean, there's a lot of alternate stories here, but I mean, I like to also believe that part of it was the pressure that was placed onto her as a Black athlete, you know, at an international stage. And I think that definitely can be translated here as well. You know, like Kisona, she's like a breakthrough story, you know, like she's an icon just by virtue of her existence. Like the fact that she has made it to the international stage alone is an act of resistance, is an act that is political in nature and that deserves to inherently be celebrated as well. So I think, yeah, it's really unfair. And I think the act of just existing and making it how far she is already an act of protest, resistance and resilience.
I think that's a fantastic point because it's not common. You know, Malaysia, badminton is a huge sport in Malaysia. Many Malaysians love the sport. My family is huge badminton fans. And it really, really struck a chord to be able to see someone that has your skin color, to have, you know, that looks like you, you know, playing on such an international stage when you know how difficult it must have been for her to just get that opportunity to even try in the first place. Deepan, you've represented Malaysia at the international stage, namely debating competitions. What has your experiences been like over the years? Can you, you know, in a way relate to what Kisona went through with that post? Have you felt that kind of similar pressure where you are, you know, carrying the community on your back when you're, you know, representing Malaysia and things like that?
Definitely. I think when you think about debating particularly, it's a spot that's really for people who are very academically privileged. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Malaysian Indians, you know, we've been cut out of the education system very strongly. We've been thrown to the back. When you look at how systems don't even care about including Indians and making spaces for Indians in education, especially when you look at the horrible quota system that we have in place right now, that we're not supposed to talk about. We will talk about it, you know? So in debating, it has been tough as well, you know, being a Malaysian Indian, being somebody who is from a family where no one else before me went to university to enter into debating and do it. And I've been very privileged as well in being able to at least have some pretty big achievements under my name, engaging in debating. But I mean, I guess I've also been privileged to not have been called a slur in the sport. But I think something that I definitely relate to is being sidelined as a Malaysian Indian.
Right.
And I don't mean to come off salty here at all, but I just want to point out that I've seen in international debating so many Malaysian Indians, I'm not just talking about myself, but Malaysian Indians who have done really good in the sport, you know, have made it to the international stage. I have a friend who is a Malaysian Indian whose name is Amrit, who judged the World Universities Debating Championship. This is the World Olympics of Debate, you know, and she was the finals judge. And not a single article was written about her. Not a single journalist approached her. Nobody in the government wanted to cover that story. But if you look at it, there have actually been instances in the past where, you know, a lot of other journalists and articles have been written about people who are prominent debaters, right? Like Syed Saddiq, for example, who gets so many articles written about him, even before he entered into politics, yeah? Don't get me wrong. And institutions like IIUM and Mara, you know, whose debaters go abroad and have done well as well, have had so many articles and parades of their achievements, but we've not received the same. And it's not salt, once again. It's just questioning, what is the difference in my achievement, in my friend's achievement as a Malaysian Indian? And why do we not deserve the same celebration? If not, controversially, more celebration.
I would also want to ask if you ever felt like, even when you're gaining these successes, right? Because a lot of times we see even in schools, and this is a, you know, something that, you know, Indian parents always ask, I feel, you know, anecdotally speaking, where it's more like, they will ask, let's say if you go to a school where it's majority Chinese or you know, things like that, where they will ask, what number did you get in class? Oh, we got number 3. Why? Who got number 1? Was it the Chinese guy or was it other people? I feel there is this thing because of the sort of structures in place and because we don't get the opportunities, people like parents and all are very, very like, you know, they want to be able to see that. And to them, and even to the students themselves, it a lot of times it means something knowing that you're a minority. And in this school, in this sea of people that don't look like you, you have attained success despite what everyone believes, whether you're able to do it or not. I wonder if you have felt similar things when you represented Malaysia at an international stage.
That's a difficult question, and it's a really good question. And it's a good pointing out of a phenomenon that we see a lot. For me particularly, I have felt that, you know, I have felt good, you know, being that breakthrough story and being somebody who made it further than others. But I have also had so many points of reflection where I look back and I think, wow, isn't it really messed up that I had to think that to begin with? Mm-hmm. You know, like, why can't I just be average or be above average and feel good about myself? Why did I have to work so hard to the point where even sometimes, actually a lot of the times, at the cost of my own mental health, at the cost of you know, worsening insecurities that I had about myself, but I had to put all of that aside because it was about making sure that I did well, you know, mm-hmm. and making sure that if I look the way I do, I must be excellent. And if I'm anything short of excellent, I'm a disappointment. And that expectation definitely caused a lot of internal torment and pain in the process. And I think in a different world, in an alternate world where I didn't have these expectations, I think I would have achieved the same thing, but I think I would be just so much more happier.
On the show with me today are Vanisha Krishnasamy and Deepan Kumar. They are the co-founders of Unmuted, which is a Malaysian collective to empower and center brown and marginalized voices. After the break, we'll be taking a look at a recent Foodpanda advertisement that appropriates ethnic Indian culture. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today are Vanisha Krishnasamy and Deepan Kumar. They are the co-founders of Unmuted, which is a Malaysian collective to empower and center brown marginalized voices. Before the break, we discussed a vile racist comment made by politician Burhanuddin Che Rahim towards National Shuttler Eski Sona. Now we're going to be taking a look at a recent Foodpanda advertisement, which was released near to Deepavali, which is coming soon in November. It was, you know, Indian cinema musical themed, but it had no Indian talents at all. How does that make sense? How do you make an ad that is centered around Indian movie styles and Indian musicals that is coming out, you know, close to Deepavali and not have a single Indian person in the advertisement? What's the logic behind that, Anisha? And what are your thoughts when you first saw this Foodpanda advertisement?
When I first saw the advertisement, I honestly laughed. You know, we laugh about it because it's a coping mechanism, right?
How
we
definitely
deal with absurdities like this. And so honestly, I laughed and I thought it was really funny that they couldn't see how wrong this was, you know, that they couldn't see that this video that went through multiple layers of approvals from pre-production all the way to post was okay to every single person throughout that streamline. So it was just very mind-boggling to me. that was okay. And I think that I will again use the same answer that I gave earlier for hearing the K slur, which is that I was disappointed, but also not surprised, and particularly so in the media industry. Particularly so when looking at it from the perspective of someone from the media industry,
right.
It happens so often. We are continuously erased from mainstream media all the time. In almost every single project that I've been involved in, I've seen this actively happen, and I've voiced it out. I've spoken to producers and directors and scriptwriters about it, and it's always, oh no, but you know, this is what the client wants. So my take in situations like this is to turn projects like this down, but I understand that this may not be what everyone can do, mm-hmm. given our situations, and especially so during the pandemic, it's difficult to turn projects down. But I guess the thing that really disappoints me is that not only did so many people participate in this advertisement, but they also didn't speak up against it in any way. So we didn't hear mm-hmm. any disagreement from the cast or the crew or the people within the production team itself. And that goes to show that everybody thought it was okay and everybody was complicit to that discrimination, that it was okay to not feature Indian people in an ad that is essentially for Indian people.
And I think that's an interesting point you bring up, Nisha. Do you think that that's a problem here in Malaysia, where there is a very sort of very little cultural awareness when it comes to cultural sensitivities, the nuances, understanding these sorts of issues? Forget about the extremists or the people who are legitimately racist. That aside, I'm talking about even people within our circles, maybe not our immediate circles, but people within our sphere. You hear this thing where they just do not understand why. Because for them, it's like, why not? We are just wearing clothes. What's the big deal? Do you think that Malaysians lack this cultural awareness where their intent, some of them, their intent may not be bad, but they just don't have the understanding?
Yes, I think that in most cases, it really is that. I don't think that the majority of us hold malice or intend to offend particularly marginalized people in this context when the culture is appropriated this way. I don't think that it's done with the intention to hurt. But however, it's important to note that the lack of understanding or the privilege to be ignorant is not a privilege that everybody has. It's particularly not a privilege that marginalized people have in most cases, especially if you're talking about marginalized people within the sphere of the media industry, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we really have to tread extra, 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 extra carefully. So I think that that kind of sensitivity should also be practiced by people of other races within the media industry as well. And I do believe there is a lack of sensitivity, definitely, that we usually see it as just, ala, tapi pinjam baju je kot. Or like, ala, kita kan semua satu Malaysia. You know, it's usually like that. Like, but we're all the same people. And I think that in itself is where the problem lies, that we see each other as entirely the same. And there's nothing wrong with seeing each other as equals to some extent when it's meant to dignify each other. But at the same time, these kinds of generalization of people also erases very important differences that actually sets us apart. And these differences need to be addressed so that we can, I think, coexist peacefully. Because now, I think what we have now in Malaysia is tolerance. And this tolerance stems from that messaging that we're all the same. So, you know, even if we think we're not the same, we just like, you know, diam-diam and accept je lah, you know, mm-hmm. situation ni. But it shouldn't be like that. And having these difficult conversations is not a bad thing. It's important to have them so that we understand that it's okay to be different and coexist. They are not mutually exclusive.
Now, Deepan, cultural appropriation, right, is a term widely used in the US. What is cultural appropriation? And can we view it here through the same lens as they view it in the US?
Yeah, this is a really good question because I've had so many people come up to me and say, yeah, why are we taking after the West? Leave American issues in America. And trust me when I say I am the biggest proponent to opposing the West. I love anti-West, anti-US sentiments. Reject the colonizer. That's great, right? Oppose Western politics. Oppose neocolonialism. Oppose the USA. But I feel like it's important to introspect a bit deeper about where cultural appropriation comes from in the West, in America. It actually comes from Black Americans, right? It comes from the minorities there and how they have been, or they have had their culture appropriated from their oppressors. And I think one of the questions that I usually get or I usually hear is that, oh, Black Americans have been through it worse, right? They've been through, for example, slavery from the white. But cultural appropriation isn't something that requires there to be something like slavery done onto you by your oppressors. We also talk about cultural appropriation with Indian Americans and white Americans as well, with the appropriation of bindis, for example, during Coachella, and not seeing the cultural significance behind it or giving it the credit it deserves to the community. We see it in Chinese Americans as well, you know, and the way they appropriate Chinese characters for things like tattoos and etc. But also, you know, we live in a society where in America you have things like Stop Asian Hate and a lot of discrimination against Asian Americans as well. So it's important to note that we also have an oppression dynamic here in Malaysia, and it is the majority against the minority, with the minority being, or the most intersectionally harmed being, Indian Malaysians. So in this context, it's important to also see that similarity and that parallel, and to note that the same kind of harms we observe in America towards minorities there are also being something that's enacted onto minorities here as well. And I think that's the key thing that you have to realize as the similarity in order for you to see why cultural appropriation, even though it's a Western concept, can apply here.
Something else people always like to say is that this is a celebration. We are celebrating Indian cultures, Deepan. We are celebrating the culture. So why is that wrong?
Listen, I love celebrations. I love celebrating cultures, okay? And I can understand why this is a difficult area to traverse when discussing this, because we are a unique multicultural society. Plus, we also have decades of governmental policy that has normalized the sharing of each other's cultures and to embrace a common Malaysian identity through concepts like One Malaysia or Bangsa Malaysia during Mahathir's time. So I can understand where the average Malaysian is coming when they say, you know, it's just an appreciation. But it's important to note, in order for something to be a proper celebration, there's usually three things. The first is that you have to give credit to the source of the culture, which we saw Foodpanda's video not doing at all, because there's no Indian in the video. I doubt there was an Indian in the production process that would have allowed something like that. Secondly, it must not reinforce stereotypes. And thirdly, and more broadly, it must not contribute to oppression. And that's the clincher, right? That's the clincher here. Because when you have these kinds of portrayals, it worsens stereotypes about these communities. It also contributes to oppression because there is this hypocrisy of taking from the Indian community whatever you like, whatever is palatable to you, whatever satisfies you and makes you feel like you can appreciate the culture, while simultaneously not taking on the political responsibility as a majority to fight for Malaysian Indian causes. Like things like, for example, the figures of incarceration for Malaysian Indian communities and the deaths of people like Dee Mugilarasu, and the list of names that we've seen of people, Malaysian Indians dying in custody, right? Educational opportunities, horrible racism in places like the housing market. These are all things that you need to take the political responsibility for. So as an ending note here of my philosophy on this, it's just, we can talk about cultural appreciation, you having untethered access to my culture, once this place becomes a fairer place for Malaysian Indians and once we are treated as equal and same citizens as everyone else. Yeah.
Nisha, I also want to get your thoughts, right? Because there's also this other layer here when we're talking about cultural appropriation, which is this idea of getting a profit, right? Because it's different where, you know, we are inviting a bunch of our colleagues and friends and Malay, Chinese, everyone, different races to our wedding. And people are all wearing Punjabi suits and saris, and that's great. But when we look at advertisements, right, like advertisements involve money, production companies and production houses are involved. That means people are getting salaries. The production houses are getting huge revenues out of it. And Food Panda is going to make the whole idea of doing making advertisements is to then, you know, increase their sales and all of it. So fundamentally, it all comes back to money. So you make an ad about Indian culture nearing Deepavali, and not an single Indian person made money from that ad, especially at least from the talent perspective.
Yes, definitely. And I don't know if the entire production crew in itself is completely dominated by those from the majority or not. I'm not sure. So I think it's best I don't speculate. Mm-hmm. But from what I understand, by the looks of it, it definitely looks like it's not content that's done by someone from our community, you know. And it's a problem when, first of all, you take a culture that is so oppressed and you sort of glorify it and misinterpret it in the process, you know, trying to make sense of it and put this culture in a pedestal, but not really doing it fairly and not really doing it justly. That's already a problem in its own. But then not featuring Indian people in the process when you're doing that is even more problematic. Because at the very least, if they would have had one Indian person, and I really cringe to say this because I do think that that's tokenization and that's mm-hmm. a whole other thing which we shouldn't really be doing. Even if they had one Indian person, I would think, oh, maybe this Indian person was okay with it, or maybe this Indian person didn't really see it as a problem. So maybe that might make me take a step back and kind of just rethink whether I'm viewing this entire situation as a victimization or not. But in situations where there is no brown person, it's a very clear, I think, action to profit. It's unethical and it's wrong. It should not be done. It's simply put, you should not be taking away from a culture without giving due credit, like Deepan said earlier, and also without, I think, acknowledging their existence. That in itself to me was what was most disappointing about the advertisement, because I did not see people like me being represented in the content. And it was a clear reflection of how production people view our importance in the industry in itself, that we are not talents that need to be featured, that we're not people whose opinions need to be weighed in when making content like this, that we don't have any creative intelligence to contribute, whether from pre to post, you know. And it just makes me feel really sad, because the reality is that we do have so many talents, you know. We have an abundance. If they really wanted to feature the Indian community, they could have done it to the best of their capabilities if they would have just given the project to a marginalized person. All they had to do was take the project and give it to an Indian person and say, hey, you do it this time, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, we trust you to do justice to this project. And it's not like there aren't producers, directors, scriptwriters, production houses that can do it. I know, at the top of my head, I know 5 amazing directors who could probably pull this off, you know. And as if we're talking about cast, at the top of my head as well, I can think about easily 5 to 10 people who could have done these roles much better justice, mm-hmm. you know. And it's just really sad to see how marginalized people are not given importance, are not seen, are not heard, are not valued in spaces like this, where we continue to try and try so hard to make a breakthrough, but we only end up somehow staying in our own bubbles, you know. So basically what I'm trying to say is that Malaysian Indians only stay within the circle of Tamil content, you know, or within the circle of Tamil music videos, or Tamil telemovies or movies in general, just basically Tamil-related content. We kind of stay stuck there, and we can't really break through to mainstream because we're not really given the access to mainstream.
Deepan, with all of that in mind, what would a proper celebration of Indian culture look like? One example that pops into my mind when it comes to other people celebrating Indian culture, or other races celebrating Indian culture, for example, is Yuna's music video, Not the Love of My Life. I'm wondering if you think that is a good example of a non-Indian wanting to showcase Indian culture and doing whatever that's necessary to do it properly. Would you say that her video is a good example of it?
Yeah, I love Yuna. I think she's phenomenal. I think she's doing great stuff. But I think, you know, the music video was actually one of the better ones, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think it's a better way forward. I think it's an indication that the majority is learning. You know, that Yuna has done her homework. She's listened. She has incorporated and actively centered a local Malaysian Indian. You know, the choreographer, Harshini Sukumaran. She was an Indian choreographer that was placed at the center of the music video. And she was focused on other talents. And the business owners were also from the Indian wedding industry. So she made sure that everything was done properly in terms of making sure that there is economic empowerment to all those that are in the stakeholder. Because functionally, when you look at a music video, it's an economic transaction, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, sure, it's art and I think it's great. You know, obviously there's an expression element to it, but it is an economic transaction and people make money off of it. And I think it's important to redistribute that money because we are an economically disenfranchised society in this country. That static reality is not going to change unless more majorities in this country take on the burden of trying to be a little bit better. And I think that then would make it a lot easier for the Malaysian Indian community. It creates, you know, this wave of new behavior when it comes to approaching how do we interact with minority culture. So I think she's definitely one of the better ones. And I think everybody can take a note from how she's done it as well. But I think can do more also, lah, you know. I'm always the kind of, you know, yeah, try harder a little bit, you know.
Sure.
Like, you know, think of more ways that you can uplift marginalized creatives beyond just a one-time feature, such as a campaign, you know, like maybe something more continuous. A lot of ways in which you can incorporate Indian creatives to allow for more sustainable forms of empowerment.
You know, whenever we are discussing this idea of cultural appropriation, there's always this thing where people assume you're making an issue out of nothing. Don't create more racial problems out of nothing, which is something you guys alluded to earlier, that, you know, Malaysia is a muhibah. We are a cultural melting pot, you know. So how do you usually respond to people who say these things, that we are a cultural melting pot? Don't, you know, simply, you know, stir the pot and you know, stoke the flames for no reason. You know, just calm down. It's just clothes. It's just a music video. There are bigger issues. You know, people are suffering. They will say, people are suffering. Why are you, you know, harping on a music video? And how do you respond to comments like these?
When you add up all those little instances where you get this kind of remark and you put them all together, it makes up for a pretty cumulative oppression that, you know, eventually you need to take note of. So people say other people are suffering. That's also a very violent dismissal of my suffering, of Malaysian Indian suffering right now, because, you know, it's delegitimizing, it's invalidating, it's dehumanizing to see parts of my culture be taken, but other parts of me be hated on. You know, that's a very jarring experience as a Malaysian Indian. And when we call out these things, it's not that we're saying we don't want Malaysia to be a wonderful country where we're all tolerant of each other and we have the spirit of muhibah. It's great. I love being in this country where there is that muhibah sentiment and where we can tolerate each other and love each other, not just tolerate, but love and appreciate each other. But that cannot happen if we are fundamentally disadvantaged in comparison to others. That cannot happen if there's no promise for a better tomorrow for our community, right? And that pain will still exist. So when somebody says muhibah, my question is just, muhibah for who? You know, who is the most privileged, who benefits the most out of you saying this? It's likely not Malaysian Indians. And that's the point. You know, people need to realize that. Stop using muhibah as a shroud, as a veil to, you know, not take accountability. That is the concern here.
I think Deepin said it perfectly. And I also just want to add that I think that a lot of times the muhibah term is used to violently silence marginalized people from voicing out the discrepancies. And I feel like that in itself is an act of discrimination, as much as the word muhibah hopes to denote otherwise, you know, but the way in which it is used is actually discrimination in itself. And it's important for us to have these discussions. We shouldn't be shying away from having these quote unquote sensitive conversations that our Malaysian community sees it as, because it points to a larger racial and systemic problem that we all can do more about. when there's some of us who benefit from these discrepancies, those of us who benefit must do more with our privilege. And to silence those who have less, to say that you should not be voicing out, you should not be talking about this because you're disturbing peace. Again, like what Deepan said, disturbing whose peace? Mm-hmm. Are we all really at peace? Or are just some of us at peace and some of us just being tolerant? I think that when we talk about racial discrimination, right, in the context of Malaysia, we always think that it is a conversation that is had to create conflict. But that really isn't the reason why we raise our concerns or we speak up for ourselves. It is to have some kind of equity, you know. That's the reason why these conversations are had. They don't come from a place of wanting to conquer and divide. They come from a place of wanting to be a proper community in all sense of the word. It comes from a very loving place. And yes, it's understandable that marginalized people, when we speak, when we talk about these things, we're angry and we're frustrated. And I think it's rightfully so. Because when you have been oppressed for so many years, you know, when it's generations after generations of oppression, it weighs on you. And to be oppressed and have to talk about oppression again and again is very tiring. It's very tiring for those who are being oppressed. So the anger is justified, though I don't necessarily think that it's always helpful. I think that as much as we can, we speak in the means that we can, and it's very difficult to reduce that anger when you feel so much and are hurt so much. But that being said, if we can have assertive yet compassionate conversations, I think we should take up space to have these conversations. And I feel in spaces like the social media sphere, we have opportunities to do that. Because it's a space where there's kind of like this unspoken agreement that we have come to learn from each other and grow together. And we have this opportunity to learn through discourse like this. So while there are some social media platforms that are very violent and toxic in nature, like TikTok and the comment section there, which can get very heated and triggering for some people in the marginalized community, there are spaces like Instagram and Facebook where healthier discourse happens, like Twitter, for example, as well. So we shouldn't shy away from talking about these things because it helps us to be better as a community and grow together as a society. And how long might we want to stay stuck like this also, right?
As we wrap this conversation up, would you all have a final message for us? Nisha, perhaps we can start with you.
When content like this takes front and center, there are many different justifications. You know, people blame agencies for taking on projects like this or companies for approving projects like this. And while I feel that it is true that those who are making decisions definitely have to do better to be more accountable, they definitely have to actively be inclusive, because if they don't do that, then they're essentially a racist organization or company. And it is what it is. It has to be said. It has to be called what it is, you know. While I do agree that those who make decisions have to take accountability, I think that everyone in society has to do the same. And if we're talking about the media industry, that would mean everybody within the production team as well, whether it's the artist, whether, you know, it's the crew. No person is too small to voice out about it, to talk about it. And the more of us who speak up about it, when there's many of us who raise concerns about it, at least, at the very least, content like this gets discussed better before being released, you know. Maybe if they would have had more discussion like this within the team in itself, prior to the release, prior to even the shooting, for example, right? They may have steered clear from coming up with a content like this. So it's so important to make sure that these kinds of discussions continue to happen and that everybody takes accountability to actively make space for marginalized people. It's not enough to say that you're not racist and then take part in projects like this, you know, be a part of projects like this. If you haven't actively made an effort to stand up for the marginalized community, then you should really do some reflecting.
Deepan,
I think two quick things. Number one is you need to be more open to learn about yourself and how society has failed you and how there are parts of you where you can acknowledge is wrong, is bad, and fix that. Even as a Malaysian Indian standing in front of you as an intersectional minority of all kinds, I am still, until today, undoing a lot of internalized racism, a lot of anti-blackness as well that is very prevalent in the Malaysian Indian community. So it's fine. It's not the end of the world if you take accountability and realize there are parts of you that were wrong. It's not that you consciously made this decision. It's that society has informed you that way. And therefore, you've developed this and you can unlearn this. And that part of unlearning it is rewarding. It's kinder to the people around you. And the last thing is just when it comes to, you know, the reality that we live in a capitalist society, right? The systems around us, the companies, they all want to make money. The way they make money is by pandering to what society deems acceptable. And your voice is a very powerful thing that can change the levers of capitalism in favor of a better world if you voice out against things that are wrong. If a company messes up in terms of representation, use your voice, create that noise that would make them lose their money or would make them question the profitability of that decision-making process. And when you can mess that up, that's a way in which you can change the systems in our favor. That's how you'll get less Food Panda videos like that and a better world and a more, like, a less tiring world for people like Malaysian Indians and other marginalized communities.
Yes, because honestly, sis Panat, we're tired.
Yes, we are.
On that note, Vanisha Deepan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Those were the co-founders of Unmuted, Vanisha Krishnasamy and Deepan Kumar. Unmuted is a Malaysian collective to empower and center brown marginalized voices. And we were discussing two issues, the K-word aimed at Malaysian badminton player Eski Sona by politician Burhanuddin Che Rahim, as well as the recent Indian movie musical-themed Food Panda advertisement. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.